A huge tree, its roots partly exposed, hung over the water. A woman, in a long clinging dress, was standing on one of the bare boughs. She was motionless, looking at them.
"The wheel," said the witcher softly. "The wheel, Captain, towards that bank, away from the tree."
The woman vanished, and a large fox slunk along the bough, dashed away and hid in the thicket. The animal seemed to be black, and only the tip of its bushy tail white.
"She's found us."
Adario Bach had also seen her.
"The vixen has found us. Blood and thunder, be quiet, both of you. Don't spread panic."
They glided on, watched by pelicans from the dead trees on the banks. Interlude. 127 years later.
"That'll be a valo, miss, yonder, beyond the hillock," said the merchant, pointing with his whip. "Half a furlong, no more. You'll be there in a choice. I head eastwards towards Maribor at the crossroads, so the time has come to part. Farewell. May the gods lead you and watch over you on your way."
"And over you, good sir,"
said Nimue, hopping down from the wagon, taking her bundle and the rest of her things, and then curtsying clumsily.
"My sincere thanks for the ride on your wagon. Back there in the forest. My sincere thanks."
She swallowed at the memory of the dark forest, deep into which the highway had led her for the last 2 days. At the memory of the huge, ghastly trees with their twisted boughs, entwined into a canopy above the deserted road. A road where she'd suddenly found herself all alone. At the memory of the horror that had seized her, and the memory of the desire to turn tail and fly. Home. Abandoning the preposterous thought of journeying into the world alone. And banishing that preposterous thought from her memory.
"My goodness, don't thank me, it's a trifle," laughed the merchant. "Anyone would help a traveller. Farewell."
"Farewell. I wish you a safe journey."
She stood for a moment at the crossroads, looking at a stone post, polished to a smooth slipperiness by the wind and rain.
"It must have stood here for ages," she thought. "Who knows? Perhaps more than 100 years? Perhaps this post remembers the year of the comet. The army of the Northern Kings marching to Brenna, and the battle with Nilfgaard?"
As every day, she repeated the route she'd learned by heart, like a magical formula, like a spell.
"Virva, Guado, Sibel, Brugge, Castafort, Mortara, Ivalo, Dorian, Anchor, Gorsvelen."
The town of Ivalo made itself known from a distance, by its noise and foul smell. The forest ended at the crossroads. Further on, there was only a bare clearing, bristling with tree stumps, stretching out far away towards the horizon and the first buildings. Smoke was trailing everywhere. Rows of iron vats, retorts for making charcoal, were smoking. There was a smell of resin. The nearer the town, the louder grew the noise. A strange metallic clank, making the ground shudder perceptibly beneath her feet. Nimue entered the town and gasped in amazement. The source of the noise and the shuddering of the ground was the most bizarre machine she had ever seen. A huge, bulbous, copper cauldron with an enormous wheel whose revolutions drove a piston shining with grease. The machine hissed, smoked, spluttered boiling water and belched steam. Then, at a certain moment, uttered a whistle. A whistle so horrifying and dreadful that Nimue was dumbfounded. But she quickly overcame her fear, even approaching closer and curiously examining the belts, which the gears of the hellish machine used to drive the saws in the mill, cutting trunks at incredible speed. She would have continued watching, but her ears began to hurt from the rumbling and grinding of the saws. She crossed a bridge. The small river below was murky and stank repugnantly, bearing wood chips, bark and flecks of foam. The town of Ivalo, however, which she had just entered, reeked like one great latrine. A latrine where, to make matters worse, somebody had insisted on roasting bad meat. Nimue, who'd spent the previous week among meadows and forests, began to choke. The town of Ivalo, which marked the end of another stage on her route, had seemed like a resting place to her.
Now she knew she wouldn't tarry any longer than was absolutely necessary, nor add Ivalo to her store of pleasant recollections. As usual, she sold a punnet of mushrooms and medicinal roots at the market. It didn't take long. She was now practiced, knowing what there was demand for, and whom she should go to with her wares. She pretended to be half-witted, owing to which she had no problem selling, the stallholders vying with each other to outwit the dull girl. She earned little, but didn't waste time, for speed mattered. The only source of clean water in the vicinity was a well in a narrow little square, and in order to fill her canteen, Nimue had to wait her turn in a lengthy queue. Acquiring provisions for the next stage of her journey went more smoothly. Enticed by the smell, she also bought several stuffed pasties, which, on closer inspection, seemed suspicious. She sat down by a dairy to eat them, while they were still tolerably fit to be consumed without seriously damaging her health, for it didn't look as though they would continue in that state for long. Opposite was a tavern called the Green Something. The sign's missing lower plank had turned the name into a riddle and intellectual challenge. A moment later, Nimue became engrossed by her attempts to guess what, apart from frogs and lettuce, could be green. She was startled out of her reverie by a loud discussion being conducted on the tavern steps by a small group of regulars.
"The Prophet Lebioda, I tell you," ranted one of them. "The legendary break! That ghost ship that vanished without trace more than 100 years back with all hands, and would later appear on the river when misfortune was in the air, manned by a ghostly crew. Many saw it. People said it would continue to appear as a spectre until the wreck was found. Well, and they finally found it."
"Where?"
"In Rivermouth, on an old riverbed, in the mud, in the very heart of a bog, what they was drying out. It was all overgrown with weed and moss. After they'd scraped off the weed and moss, they found the inscription, 'The Prophet Lebioda.'"
"And treasure? Did they find any treasure? There was meant to be treasure there, in the hold. Did they find any?"
"No one knows. The priests, they say, confiscated the wreck, calling it a holy relic."
"That? What nonsense," hiccuped another regular. "Believing in them childish tales. They found some old tub and then at once, ghosts, ship, treasure relics. I tell you all, that's bullshit, trashy writing, foolish rumours, old wives' tales. I say, you there, wench, who be you? Who's are you?"
"My own."
Nimue had a ready answer by then.
"Brush your hair aside, and show us your ear, for you look like elven spawn, and we don't want elven half-breeds here."
"Let me be, for I don't incommode you, and I'll soon be setting off."
"Ah, and whither do you go?"
"To Dorian."
Nimue had also learned to also give as her destination only the next stage, in order never, ever to reveal the final objective of her trek, because that only caused great merriment.
"Ho, ho! You've a long road ahead of you."
"Hence I am about to go. And I'll just tell you, noble gentleman, that the Prophet Lebioda wasn't carrying any treasure. The legend doesn't say anything about that. The ship vanished and became a ghost because she was cursed, and her skipper hadn't acted on good advice. The witcher who was there advised them to turn the ship around, not to venture into an offshoot of the river until he'd removed the curse." "I read about that."
"Still wet behind the ears and such a clever clogs,"
pronounced the first regular.
"You should be sweeping floors, wench, minding pots and laundering smalls, simple as that. Says she could read. Whatever next?"
"A witcher?"
snorted a third.
"Tall tales, all but tall tales."
"If you're such a know-it-all, you must have heard of our Magpie Forest," interjected another.
"What? You haven't?
Then we'll tell you. Something evil lurks there. But it awakes every few years, and then woe betide anyone who wanders through the forest. And your route, if you're truly headed for Dorian, passes right through Magpie Forest."
"And do any trees still stand there? For you've cut down everything. Nothing but bare clearings remain."
"Just look what a know-it-all she is, a mouthy striplet. What's a forest for if not to be cut down, eh? What we felled, we felled. What remains, remains.
But the woodcutters fear to enter Magpie Forest. Such a horror is there. You'll see for yourself, if you get that far. You'll piss in your pants from fear."
"I'd better be off, then. Virva, Guado, Sibel, Bruga, Castlefort, Mortara, Ivalo, Dorian, Anchor, Gorsfelen. I'm Nimue Veglader Ap Gwyn. I'm headed for Gorsfelen, to Aretusa, to the school of sorceresses on the Isle of Thaneth.
Chapter 15.
You've made a pretty mess, Padlurak.
Javel Fish spat furiously.
You've got us in a pretty tangle. We've been wandering around these offshoots for an hour. I've heard about these bogs. I've heard evil things about them. People and ships perish here. Where's the river? Where's the shipping channel? What? Shut your trap, by thunder,
said the captain in annoyance.
Where's the shipping channel? Where's the shipping lane? Up my arse, that's where. So clever, are you? Be my guest. Now's a chance to distinguish yourself. There's another fork. Where shall we sail, smart Alec? To port, as the current carries us? Or perhaps you'll order us starboard.
Fish snorted and turned his back on him. Padlorak grabbed the wheel and steered the cutter into the left branch. The leadsman gave a cry. Then a moment later, Kevinar van Vliet yelled, but much louder.
Away from the bank, Padlorak, screamed Petru Cobbin. Hard to starboard. Away from the bank. Away from the bank.
What is it?
Serpents. Don't you see them? Serpents!
Adario Bach swore. The left bank was teeming with snakes. The reptiles were writhing among the reeds and riverside weeds, crawling over half-submerged trunks, dangling down, hissing from overhanging branches. Geralt recognized cottonmouths, rattlesnakes, jararacas, boomslangs, green bush vipers, puff adders, arietes, black mambas, and others he didn't know. The entire crew of the Prophet fled in panic from the port side, yelling at various pitches. Kevinar van Vliet ran astern and squatted down, trembling all over, behind the Witcher. Padlorak turned the wheel, and the cutter began to change course. Geralt placed his hand on Padlorak's shoulder.
No, he said. Hold the course as you were. Don't go near the starboard bank.
But they're snakes!
Padlorak pointed at the branch they were approaching, hung all over with hissing reptiles.
They'll drop onto the deck!
There are no snakes. Hold the course, away from the starboard bank.
The sheets of the mainmast caught on a hanging branch. Several snakes coiled themselves around them, and several others, including two mambas, dropped onto the deck. Raising their heads and hissing, they attacked the men huddled up against the starboard side. Fish and Cobbin fled aft, and the deckhands, yelling, bolted astern. One of them jumped into the water and disappeared before he could cry out. Blood frothed on the surface.
"A la poche!" shouted the Witcher,
pointing at a wave and a dark shape moving away.
"It's real, unlike the snakes."
"I detest reptiles,"
sobbed Kevinar van Vliet, huddled up by the side.
"I detest snakes."
"There aren't any snakes, and there weren't any. It's an illusion."
The deckhands shouted and rubbed their eyes. The snakes had vanished, both from the deck and from the bank. They hadn't even left any tracks.
What?
Petru Cobbin grunted.
What was it?
An illusion, repeated Geralt. The Aguara has caught up with us.
You what?
The vixen. She's creating illusions to confuse us. I wonder how long she's been doing it. The storm was probably genuine, but there were two offshoots. The captain's eyes didn't deceive him. The Aguara cloaked one of the offshoots in an illusion and faked the compass needle. She also created the illusion of the snakes.
Which are tall tales, Fish snorted. Elven superstitions. Our wives' tales.
What? Some old fox has abilities like that? Hides rivers, confounds compasses, conjures up serpents where there aren't any. Fiddlesticks. I tell you, it's these waters.
We were poisoned by vapours, venomous swamp gases and miasmas. That's what caused those hallucinations.
They're illusions created by the Aguara.
Do you take us for fools? Yelled Cobbin. Illusions? What illusions? Those were real vipers. You all saw them, didn't you? Heard the hissing? I even smelled their stench.
That was an illusion. The snakes weren't real.
The Prophet's sheets snagged on overhanging branches again.
That's a hallucination, is it?
Asked one of the deckhands, holding out his hand.
An illusion? That snake isn't real?
No. Stand still,
The huge Ariete, hanging from a bough, gave a blood-curdling hiss and struck like lightning, sinking its fangs into the sailor's neck, once, twice. The deckhand gave a piercing scream, fell, shaking in convulsions, banging the back of his head rhythmically against the deck. Foam appeared on his lips, and blood began to ooze from his eyes. He was dead before they could get to him. The Witcher covered the body in a canvas sheet.
"Damn it, man," he said. "Be heedful. Not everything here is a mirage."
"Beware,"
yelled the sailor in the bow.
"Beware! There's a whirlpool ahead of us. A whirlpool!"
The old riverbed branched again. The left branch, the one the current was carrying them into, was swirling and churned up in a raging whirlpool. The swirling maelstrom was surging with froth like soup in a cauldron. Logs and branches, and even an entire tree with a forked crown, were revolving in the whirlpool. The leadsman fled from the bow and the others began to yell. Podlorak stood calmly. He turned the wheel, steering the cutter towards the calmer offshoot to the right. He wiped his forehead.
"Just in time. Would have been ill if that whirlpool had sacked us in. Aye, would have given us a right old spinning."
"Whirlpools," shouted Cobbin. "Lopastres, alligators, leeches. We don't need no illusions. These swamps are teeming with monstrosities, with reptiles, with every kind of venomous filth. It's too bad that we've strayed here. Many ships have vanished here."
Adario Bark finished the sentence pointing.
"And that's probably real."
There was a wreck lying stuck in the mud on the right bank. It was rotten and smashed, buried up to the bulwarks, covered in waterweed, coiled around with vines and moss. They observed it as the prophet glided past, borne by the faint current. Podlorak prodded Geralt with his elbow.
"Master Witcher," he said softly, "the compass has gone too lally again. According to the needle, we've moved from an eastwards course to a southern. If it's not a Valpine trick, it's not good. No one has ever charted these swamps, but it's none they extend southwards from the shipping channel. So we're being carried into the very heart of them."
"But we're drifting," observed Adario Bach. "There's no wind. We're being borne by the current. And the current means we're joining the river current of the Puntar."
"Not necessarily," said Geralt, shaking his head. "I've heard about these old river courses. The direction of the flow can change, depending on whether the tide's coming in or going out. And don't forget about the Aguara. This might also be an illusion."
The banks were still densely covered in cypresses, and large pot-bellied tupelos, bulbous at the base, were also growing more common. Many of the trees were dead and dry. Dense festoons of bromeliads hung from the decayed trunks and branches, their leaves shining silver in the sun. Egrets lay in wait on the branches, surveying the passing prophet with unmoving eyes. The leadsman shouted. This time, everybody saw it. Once again, she was standing on a bough hanging over the water, erect and motionless. Podlorak unhurriedly leaned on a handle, steering the cutter towards the left bank, and the vixen suddenly barked loudly and piercingly. She barked again as the prophet sailed past. A large fox flashed across the bow and hid in the undergrowth.
"That was a warning," said the Witcher, when the hubbub on deck had quietened down. "A warning and a challenge. Or rather, a demand."
"We would free the girl," Adario Bach added astutely. "Of course we would, but we can't free her if she's dead."
Kevinar van Vliet groaned and clutched his temples. Wet, dirty and terrified, he no longer resembled a merchant who could afford his own ship, more an urchin caught scrumping plums.
"What to do?" he moaned. "What to do?"
"I know," Javel Fish suddenly declared. "We'll fasten the dead wench to a barrel and toss her overboard. The vixen will stop to mourn the pup. We'll gain time."
"Shame on you, Mr. Fish."
The glovemaker's voice suddenly hardened.
"It doesn't do to treat a corpse thus. It's not civilized."
"And was she civilized? A she-elf? On top of that, half an animal? I'll tell you, that barrel's a good idea."
"That idea could only occur to a complete idiot," said Adario Bach, drawing out his words.
"And it would be the death of us all. If the vixen realizes we've killed the girl, we're finished."
"It wasn't us as killed the pup," muttered in Petru Cobbin.
before Fish, now scarlet with anger, could react.
It wasn't us. Paula, he did it. He's to blame. We're clean.
That's right,
confirmed Fish, turning not towards Van Vliet and the Witcher, but to Podlorik and the deckhands.
Paula, he's guilty. Let the vixen take vengeance on him. We'll shove him in a boat with a corpse, and they can drift away. And meanwhile, we'll...
Cobbin and several deckhands received the idea with an enthusiastic cry, but Podlorak immediately dampened their enthusiasm.
I shan't permit it, he said.
Nor I.
Kevinar Van Vliet was pale.
Mr. Parlihy may indeed be guilty. Perhaps it's true that his deed calls for punishment. But abandon him? Leave him to his death? I will not agree.
It is death or ours,
yelled Fish.
For what are we to do? Witcher, will you protect us when the she-fox boards the craft?
I shall.
A silence fell. The prophet Leviodha drifted among the stinking water, seething with bubbles, dragging behind it garlands of waterweed. Egrets and pelicans watched them from the branches. The leadsman in the bow warned them with a cry, and a moment later they all began to shout, to see the rotten wreck covered in climbing plants and weeds. It was the same wreck they'd passed an hour before.
We're sailing around in circles,
the dwarf confirmed the fact.
We're back where we started.
The she-fox has caught us in a trap. There's only one way out.
Geralt pointed at the left offshoot and the whirlpool seething in it.
To sail through that.
Through that geyser, yelled Fish. Have you gone quite mad? It'll smash us to pieces.
Smash us to pieces, confirmed Podlorak.
Or capsize us, or throw us onto the bog, and we'll end up like that wreck. See those trees being tossed about in the maelstrom? That whirlpool is tremendously powerful.
Indeed, it is.
Because it's probably an illusion. I think it's another of the Aguara's illusions.
You think? You're a witcher and you can't tell?
I'd recognize a weaker illusion, and these ones are incredibly powerful. But I reckon...
You reckon? And if you're wrong?
We have no choice, snapped Podlorak.
Either we go through the whirlpool, or we sail around in circles.
To our deaths,
Adario Bach finished his sentence. To our miserable deaths. Every few moments, the boughs of the trees spinning around in the whirlpool stuck up out of the water, like the outstretched arms of a drowned corpse. The whirlpool churned, seethed, surged and sprayed foam. The prophet shivered and suddenly shot forward, sucked into the maelstrom. The tree being tossed by the whirlpool slammed against the side, splashing foam. The cutter began to rock and spin around quicker and quicker. The entire crew were yelling at various pitches. And suddenly, everything went quiet. The water calmed down, and the surface became smooth. The prophet Leviodha drifted very slowly between the tupelos on the banks.
You are right, Geralt, said Adario Bach,
clearing his throat.
It was an illusion after all.
Podlorak looked long at the Witcher and said nothing. He finally took off his cap. His crown, as it turned out, was as shiny as an egg.
I signed up for river navigation, he finally croaked, because my wife asked me to. It'd be safer on the river, she said. Safer than on the sea. I won't have to fret each time you set sail, she said.
He put his cap back on, shook his head, then tightly grabbed a handle of the wheel.
Is that it?
Kevinar Van Vliet whimpered from under the cockpit.
Oh, we're safe now.
No one answered his question. The water was thick with algae and duckweed. Cypresses began to dominate the riverside trees, their pneumatophores, or aerial roots, some of them almost 6 feet tall, sticking up densely from the bog and the shallows by the bank. Turtles basked on islands of weed. Frogs croaked. This time they heard her before they saw her. A loud, raucous barking, like a threat or a warning being intoned. She appeared on the bank in her vulpine form, on a withered, overturned tree trunk. She was barking, holding her head up high. Geralt detected strange notes in her voice, and understood that apart from the threats, there was an order. But it wasn't them she was giving orders to. The water under the trunk suddenly frothed, and a monster emerged. It was enormous, covered all over in a greenish-brown pattern of tear-shaped scales. It gobbled and squelched, obediently following the vixen's order, and swam, churning up the water, straight at the prophet.
"Is that..."
Adario Bach swallowed.
"Is that an illusion too?"
"Not exactly," said Geralt. "It's a Vodyanoi." He yelled at Podlorak and the deckhands.
"She's bewitched a Vodyanoi and set it on us. Bortoks! All hands to the Bortoks!"
The Vodyanoi broke the surface alongside the ship, and they saw the flat, algae-covered head, the bulging fishy eyes, and the conical teeth in its great maw. The monster struck the side furiously once, twice, making the whole ship shudder. When the crew came running up with boat hooks, it fled and dived, only to emerge with a splash beyond the stern a moment later, right by the rudder blade, which it caught in its teeth and shook until it creaked.
"It'll break the rudder!"
Podlorak bellowed, trying to stab the monster with a boat hook.
"It'll break the rudder! Grab the halyards and raise it! Drive the bastard away from the rudder!"
The Vodyanoi chewed and jerked the rudder, oblivious to the cries and jabs of the boat hooks. The blade gave way, and a chunk of wood was left in the creature's teeth. It had either decided that was enough, or the she-fox's spell had lost its force. Suffice it to say that it dived and disappeared. They heard the aguara barking from the bank.
"What next?"
yelled Podlorak, waving his arms.
"What will she do next? Master Witcher!"
"By the gods,"
sobbed Kevinar van Vliet.
"Forgive us for not believing. Forgive us for killing the little girl. Ye gods, save us."
They suddenly felt a breeze on their faces. The pennant on the prophet, previously hanging pitifully, fluttered and the boom creaked.
"It's opening out,"
Fish shouted from the bow.
"Over there! Over there! A broad water! There's no doubt it's the river! Sail over there, skipper! Over there!"
The river channel was indeed beginning to widen, and something looking like broad water stretched beyond the green wall of reeds.
"We did it!" called Corbin. "Ah, we've won! We've escaped from the swamp!"
"By the Mark One!"
yelled the leadsman.
"By the Mark One!
All are over!"
roared Podlorak, shoving the helmsman away and carrying out his own order.
"Shallows!"
The Prophet Leviota's prow turned towards the offshoot, bristling with new metaphors.
"Where are you going?"
Fish bellowed.
"What are you doing? Sail for the broad water! Over there! Over there!" "We can't! There's a shallow there! We get stuck! We'll sail to the broad water along an offshoot! It's deeper here!"
They heard the aguara bark again, but didn't see her. Adario Bach tugged Geralt's sleeve. Petru Cobbin emerged from the companionway of the afterpeak, dragging Parlahi, who could barely stay on his feet, by the collar. A sailor followed him carrying the girl, wrapped in a cloak. The other four deckhands stood steadfastly beside them, facing the Witcher. They were holding battle axes, tridents and iron hooks.
"You can't stop us, good sir,"
rasped the tallest of them.
"We want to live. The time has come to act."
"Leave the child," drawled Geralt. "Let the merchant go, Cobbin."
"No, sir."
The sailor shook his head.
"We'll toss the body and the merchant overboard. They'll stop the beast. Then we'll get away."
"And don't you lot interfere,"
wheezed another.
"We've nothing against you, but don't stand in our way, because you'll get hurt."
Kevinar van Vliet curled up by the side and sobbed, turning his head away. Podlorak also looked away resignedly and pursed his lips. He clearly wouldn't react to his own crew's mutiny.
"Yes, that's right," said Petru Cobbin, shoving Parley. "Toss the merchant and the dead vixen overboard. That's our only chance of escape. Out of the way, Witcher. Go on, boys, into the boat with them."
"What boat?" asked Adario Bach calmly. "Do you mean that one, perhaps?"
Javil Fish, hunched over the oars of a boat, was rowing, heading for the broad water, already quite far from the prophet. He was rowing hard, The oar blades were splashing water and strewing waterweed around.
Fish! Yelled Cobby. You bastard! You fucking orson!
Fish turned around and raised his middle finger at them, then took up the oars again. But he didn't get far. In full view of the Prophet's crew, the boat suddenly shot up in a jet of water, and they saw the toothy jaws of a gigantic crocodile, its tail thrashing. Fish flew overboard and began to swim, screaming all the while towards the bank where cypress roots bristled in the shallows. The crocodile set off in pursuit, but the palisade of pneumatophores impeded its progress. Fish swam to the bank and flopped down chest first on a boulder lying there. But it wasn't a boulder. An enormous lizard-like turtle opened its jaws and seized Fish by his upper arm. He howled, struggled, kicked, flinging mud around. The crocodile broke the surface and caught him by the leg. Fish screamed. For a moment, it wasn't clear which of the two reptiles would catch Fish, the turtle or the crocodile. But finally, both of them got something. An arm, with a white, club-shaped bone sticking out of bloody pulp, was left in the turtle's jaws. The crocodile took the rest of Fish's body. A large red patch floated on the surface of the murky water. Geralt took advantage of the crew's stupefaction. He snatched the dead girl from the deckhand and retreated towards the bow. Adario Bach stood beside him, armed with a boathook. Neither Cobbin nor any of the sailors tried to oppose him. On the contrary, they all ran hastily to the stern. Hastily, not to say in a panic. Their faces suddenly took on a deathly pallor. Kevinar van Vliet, huddled by the side, hid his head between his knees and covered it with his arms. Geralt turned around. Whether Podlorak hadn't been paying attention, or the rudder, damaged by the Vodjinoi, wasn't working. Suffice it to say that the cutter had sailed right under some hanging boughs and was caught among fallen tree trunks. The Aguara took advantage of it. She leapt down onto the prow, nimbly, lightly, and noiselessly, in her vulpine form. Previously, he'd seen her against the sky, when she had seemed black, pitch black. She wasn't. Her fur was dark, and her brush ended in a snow-white blotch, but grey prevailed in her colouring, particularly on her head, which was more typical of a Corsac fox than a silver one. She metamorphosed, growing larger and transforming into a tall woman, with a fox's head, pointed ears and an elongated muzzle. Rows of fangs flashed when she opened her jaws. Geralt knelt down, placed the little girl's body gently on the deck, and retreated. The Aguara howled piercingly, snapped her toothy jaws, and stepped towards him. Parlahi screamed, waving his arms in panic, tore himself away from Cobbin's grasp, and jumped overboard. He sank at once. Van Vliet was weeping. Cobbin and the deckhands, still pale, gathered around Podlorak. Podlorak removed his cap. The medallion around the witch's neck twitched powerfully, vibrated, and made its presence felt. The Aguara kneeled over the girl, making strange noises, neither growling nor hissing. She suddenly raised her head and bared her fangs. She snarled softly, and a fire flared up in her eyes. Geralt didn't move. "We are to blame," he said. "Something truly ill has happened. But may no worse things occur. I cannot allow you to harm these men. I shall not allow it." The vixen stood up, lifting the little girl. She swept her gaze over them all, and finally looked at Geralt.
"You! Stort! In my way!"
she barked, clearly, slowly enunciating each word.
"In their defense!"
He didn't answer.
"I am taking my daughter,"
she finished.
"That is more important than your lives. But it was you who stood in their defense O white-haired one. Thus I shall come looking for you. One day, when you have forgotten, and will be least expecting it.
She hopped nimbly onto the bulwark, and then onto a fallen trunk, and disappeared into the undergrowth. In the silence that fell, only Van Vliet's sobbing could be heard. The wind dropped, and it became muggy. The Prophet Lebioda, pushed by the current, freed itself from the boughs and drifted down the middle of the offshoot. But Lorek wiped his eyes and forehead with his cap. The leadsman cried. Cobbin cried. And then the others added their voices. The thatched roofs of cottages could suddenly be seen beyond the thicket of reeds and wild rice. They saw nets drying on poles, a yellow strip of sandy beach, a jetty, and further away, beyond the trees on the headland, the wide river beneath a blue sky.
The river! The river! At last!
They all shouted. The deckhands, Petru Cobbin and Van Vliet. Only Geralt and Adario Bach didn't join in the yelling. But Lorak, pushing on the wheel, also said nothing.
What are you doing? Yelled Cobbin. Where are you going? Head for the river! Over there! For the river!
Not a chance,
said the captain, and there was despair and resignation in his voice.
We're becalmed. The ship barely responds to the wheel, and the current grows stronger. We're drifting. It's pushing us, carrying us into the offshoot again, back into the swamp.
No!
Cobbin swore and leapt overboard and swam towards the beach. All the sailors followed his example. Geralt was unable to stop any of them. Adario Bach roughly shoved down Van Vliet, who was preparing to jump.
Blue sky, he said.
A golden, sandy beach, the river.
It's too beautiful to be true, meaning it isn't.
And suddenly, the image shimmered. Suddenly, where a moment earlier there had been fishing cottages, a golden beach and the river beyond the headland, the Witcher, for a brief moment, saw a spider's web of Tillandsia, trailing right down to the water from the boughs of decaying trees. Swampy banks, cypresses bristling with new metaphors. Bubbles rising up from the murky depths. A sea of water plants, an endless labyrinth of branches. For a second, he saw what the Aguara's final illusion had been hiding. The men in the water began to suddenly scream and thrash around, and disappear below the surface, one by one. Petru Cobbin came up for air, choking and screaming, covered entirely in writhing, striped leeches as fat as eels. Then he sank below the water, and didn't come up again.
Geralt?
Adario Bach used the boat hook to pull the small boat, which had survived the encounter with the crocodile, and had now drifted to the side of the ship. The dwarf jumped in, and Geralt passed him the still stupefied Van Vliet.
Captain.
But Lorak waved his cap at them.
No, Master Witcher. I shall not abandon my ship. I'll guide her into port, whatever happens. And if not, I'll go down to the bottom with her. Farewell.
The Prophet Lebioda drifted calmly and majestically, gliding into an offshoot and vanishing from sight. Adario Bach spat on his hands, hunched forward and pulled on the oars. The boat sped over the water.
Where to? To the broad water beyond the shallows. The river's there, I'm certain. We'll join the shipping channel and come across a ship. And if not, we'll row this boat all the way to Novigrad. And Lorak? He'll cope, if it's his destiny.
Kevinar Van Vliet wept. Adario rowed. The sky had grown dark. They heard the distant rumble of thunder.
A storm's coming, said the dwarf. We'll get bloody soaked.
Geralt snorted, and then began to laugh, heartily and sincerely, and infectiously, because a moment later they were both laughing. Adario rowed with powerful, even strokes. The boat skipped over the water like an arrow.
You row as though you've been doing it all your life, said Geralt,
wiping his eyes wet with tears.
I thought dwarves didn't know how to sail or swim.
You're succumbing to stereotypes.
Interlude. 4 days later. The auction house of the brothers Borsody was located in a small square off the main street, which was indeed Novigrad's main road, and connected the town square with the Temple of Eternal Fire. At the beginning of the brothers' career, when they traded horses and sheep, they had only been able to afford a shack beyond the town walls. 42 years after founding their auction house, they now occupied an impressive 3-story building in the most elegant quarter of the city. It had remained in the family's possession, but the objects at auction were now exclusively precious stones, chiefly diamonds and works of art, antiques and collector's items. The auctions took place once a quarter, always on a Friday. That day, the auction room was full to bursting.
There are a good 100 people, thought Antea Deris.
The buzz and murmur quietened down. The auctioneer, Abner de Navarette, took his place behind the podium. As usual, de Navarette looked splendid in a black velvet jerkin and waistcoat with golden brocade. Princes could have envied him his noble looks and physiognomy, and aristocrats his bearing and manners. It was an open secret that Abner de Navarette really was an aristocrat, banished from his family and disinherited for drunkenness, profligacy and debauchery. Had it not been for the Borsody family, Abner de Navarette would have lived by begging. But the Borsodys needed an auctioneer with aristocratic looks, and none of the other candidates could equal Abner de Navarette in that regard.
"Good evening, ladies and gentlemen," he said in a voice as velvety as his jacket. "Welcome to the Borsodys Auction House for the quarterly auction of art treasures and antiques. The collection under the hammer today, which you became acquainted with in our gallery, is unique and comes entirely from private owners. The vast majority of you, I note, are regular guests and clients, familiar with the rules of our house and the regulations that apply during auctions. Everybody here was given on entry a brochure containing the regulations. I thus presume that you are all informed regarding the rules and aware of the consequences of breaking them. Let us then begin without delay. Lot number one, a nephrite group figure, depicting a nymph, with 3 fawns. It was made, according to our experts, by gnomes, dated as being 100 years old. Starting price, 200 crowns. I see 250. Going once? Going twice? Going 3 times. Sold to the gentleman with number 36. 2 clerks, perched at neighbouring desks, diligently wrote down the results of the sales. Lot number 2. In Ogmab Teathmoch, a collection of elven tales and poems, richly illustrated, mint condition. Starting price, 500 crowns. 550 to Merchant Hoffmeyer. Councillor Drofis, 600. Mr. Hoffmeyer, 650. No more bids? Sold for 650 crowns to Mr. Hoffmeyer of Hirundum. Lot number 3. An ivory device of a curved and elongated shape, probably used for massage. Foreign provenance, age unknown. Starting price, 100 crowns. To my left, 150. 200, the lady in the mask with number 43. 250, the lady in the veil with number 8. Do I hear 300? 300 to the wife of apothecary Vosterkratz. 350, going for the last time. Sold for 350 crowns to the lady with number 43. Lot number 4, Antidotarius Magnus, a unique medical treatise published by Castel Graupian University at the beginning of the Academy's existence. Starting price, 800 crowns. I see 850. Dr. Onazorg, 900. 1,000, the Honourable Marty Sodergren. Any more bids? Sold for 1,000 crowns to the Honourable Sodergren. Lot number 5, Liber de Naturis Bestiarum, a rare edition, bound in beechwood boards, ornately illustrated by... Lot number 6, a girl with a kitten, portrait en trois quarts, oil on canvas, the Sintron School. Starting price... Lot number 7, a bell with a handle, brass, dwarven work. The age of the item is difficult to ascertain, but it is without doubt antique. There is an engraving on the rim in dwarven runes reading, "Why are you ringing it, you twat?" Starting price? Lot number 8. Oils and tempera on canvas, artist unknown. A masterpiece. Please observe the rare use of colour, the play of pigments and the dynamics of the light, the semi-dark mood and the splendid colours of a majestically rendered sylvan landscape. And please note the main figure in the work's central position, a stag in its rutting ground, in atmospheric chiaroscuro. Starting price. Lot number 9, Imago Mundi, also known as Mundus Novus. An extremely rare book, only one copy in the possession of the University of Oxenfurt and a few in private hands. Bound in cordovan. Excellent condition. Starting price, 1,500 crowns. 1,600, the Honourable Vime Vivaldi. 1,650, the Reverend Prochaska. 1,700, the lady at the back of the room. 1,800, Master Vivaldi. 1,850, the Reverend Prochaska. 1,900, Mr. Vivaldi. Bravo, Reverend Prochaska. 2,000 crowns. 2,100, Mr. Vivaldi. Do I hear 2,200?
That book is godless. It contains a heretical message. It ought to be burned. I want to buy it to burn it. 2,200 crowns.
2,500, snorted Vime Vivaldi, stroking a well-groomed white beard. Can you top that, you devout arsonist?
It's a scandal. Mammon is triumphing over probity. Pagan dwarves are treated better than people. I shall complain to the authorities.
Sold for 2,500 crowns to Mr. Vivaldi, Abner de Navarette announced calmly. However, I remind the Reverend Prochaska about the rules and regulations of the Borsody Auction House.
I'm leaving.
Farewell. Please forgive the disturbance. It can happen that the uniqueness and wealth of the Borsody Auction House's portfolio calls forth strong emotions. Let us continue. Lot number 10. An absolute curio, an exceptional find. 2 Witcher swords. The house has decided not to offer them separately, but as a set, in honour of the Witcher whom they served years ago. The first sword made of steel from a meteorite. The blade was forged and sharpened in Mahakam. There are authentic dwarven punched patterns, confirmed by our experts. The other sword is silver. There are runic signs and glyphs confirming its originality, on the crossguard and along the entire length of the blade. Starting price, 1,000 crowns for the set. The gentleman with number 17, 1,050. Any more bids? Do I hear 1,100? For such rare items? Shit, not much money, muttered Nikifor Moors, court clerk, who was sitting in the back row, by turns nervously clenching his ink-stained fingers into a fist and pulling his fingers through his thinning hair. I knew it wasn't worth bothering. And Ter Deris shut him up with a hiss. Count Horvath, 1,100. The gentleman with number 17, 1,200. The Honourable Nino Cianfanelli, 1,500. The gentleman in the mask, 1,600. The gentleman with number 17, 1,700. Count Horvath, 1,800. The gentleman in the mask, 2,000. The Honourable Master Cianfanelli, 2,100. The gentleman in the mask, 2,200. Any more bids? The Honourable Master Cianfanelli, 2,500. The gentleman with number 17? The gentleman with number 17 was suddenly seized under the armpits by 2 burly thugs who had entered the room unnoticed.
You're Osa Fuerte, known as Needle, drawled a third thug, tapping the arrested man in the chest with a club. A hired killer with a warrant issued for his apprehension. You are under arrest. Take him away.
3,000!
Yelled Yerosef Huerte, known as Needle, waving the sign with the number 17 that he was still holding.
3,000!
I'm sorry, said Abner de Navarette coldly. It's the rules. A bidder's offer is cancelled on the event of his arrest. The current bid is 2,500 offered by the Honourable Master Cianfanelli. Do I hear a higher bid? Count Horvath, 2,600. The gentleman in the mask, 2,700. The Honourable Master Cianfanelli, 3,000. Going once? Going twice?
4,000.
Oh, the Honourable Molnar Giancardi. Bravo! 4,000 crowns. Do I hear 4,500?
I wanted them for my son,
snapped Nino Cianfanelli.
And you have only daughters, Molnar. What do you want with those swords? Ah, well, have it your own way. I yield.
Sold, declared de Navaret, to the Honourable Master Molnar Jankari for 4,000 crowns. Let us go on, noble ladies and gentlemen. Lot number 11, a cloak of monkey fur. Nikifor Moors, joyful and grinning like a weasel in a chicken coop, slapped Antaeaderis on the back. Hard. Only the last remnants of her will prevented Antaea from punching him in the mouth.
We're leaving, she hissed. And the money?
After the auction is over and the formalities have been completed, that will take some time. Ignoring the grumbling of Nikifor Moors, Antaea walked towards the door. She was aware of somebody observing her and glanced surreptitiously. A woman, with black hair, attired in black and white, with an obsidian star hanging in her cleavage. She felt a shiver. Antaea had been right. The formalities did take some time. They could only go to the bank 2 days later. It was a branch of one of the dwarven banks, smelling, like all the others, of money, wax and mahogany panelling.
The sum to be paid is 3,366 crowns, declared the clerk, after subtracting the bank's charges of 1%.
The bolster is 15, the bank 1, growled Nikifor Moors. They take a cut from everything. They like robbery. Hand over the cash.
1 moment.
Antaea stopped him. First, let's sort out our affairs, yours and mine. I'm also due a commission of 400 crowns.
Hold on, hold on,
yelled Moors, attracting the gaze of other clerks and customers.
What 400? I barely got 3,000 and a few pennies from the Borsodies.
According to the contract, I'm owed 10% of the sale price. The costs are your affair, and they apply only to you.
What are you?
Antaeaderis looked at him. That was enough. There wasn't much resemblance between Antaea and her father, but Antaea could glare just like he did, just like Pyrrhal Pratt. Moors cringed beneath her gaze.
Please make out a cheque for 400 crowns from the sum to be paid, she instructed the clerk. I know the bank takes a commission. I accept that.
And my dough in cash?
The court scribe pointed to the large leather satchel he was lugging.
I'll take it home and hide it away safely. No thieving banks are going to fleece me for a commission.
It's a considerable sum, said the clerk, standing up. Please, wait here.
As he left the counter, the clerk opened the door leading to the rear for a moment. But Antaea could have sworn that for a second she saw a black-haired woman dressed in black and white. She felt a shiver.
Thank you, Molnar, said Yennefer. I won't forget this favour.
What are you thanking me for? Smiled Molnar Jankiadi. What have I done? What service have I rendered? That I bought a certain lot at auction? Paying for it with money from your private account?
And perhaps that I turned away when you cast that spell a moment ago?
I turned away because I was watching that agent from the window as she walked away, gracefully swaying this and that. She's a dame to my taste, I don't deny it, although I'm not fond of human females. Will your spell cause her problems too?
No, interrupted the sorceress. Nothing will happen to her. She took a check, not gold.
Indeed. You will take away the witch's swords at once, I presume. After all, to him they mean everything.
Yennefer completed his sentence.
He's bound to them by destiny.
I know.
I know, indeed. He told me. And I've begun to believe it. No, Molnar, I won't take the swords today. They can remain in the safe deposit. I'll soon send an authorized person to collect them. I leave Novigrad this very day.
As do I. I'm riding to Tritagor. I have to inspect the branch there. Then I'm going home to Gors Velen.
Well, thank you once again. Farewell, O dwarf.
Farewell, O sorceress.
Interlude. Precisely 100 hours after the gold was taken from the Jankardi's bank in Novigrad.
You're banned from entry, said the doorman Tarp. And well aware of that, move away from the steps. Ever seen this, peasant?
Nikifor Moors shook and jingled a fat pouch.
Ever seen so much gold at one time? Out of my way, a nobleman is coming through, a wealthy lord.
Stand aside, churl.
Let him in, Tharp.
Phoebus Ravenga emerged from inside the osteria.
I don't want any disturbance here. The customers are growing anxious, and you, beware. You've cheated me once, there won't be a second time. You'd better have the means to pay this time, Moose.
Mr. Moose?
The scribe shoved Tharp aside.
Mister! Beware how you address me, innkeeper. Wine!
He cried, lounging back in a chair.
The dearest you have!
Our dearest costs 60 crowns, the maitre d'hotel stated gravely.
I can afford it. Give me a whole jug and pronto.
Be quiet, Ravenga admonished him.
Be quiet, Moors.
Don't silence me, mountebank. Trickster, upstart. Who are you to silence me? A gilded sign, but with muck still on your boots. And shit will always be shit. Take a look here. Ever seen so much gold at one time? Well?
Nikifor Moors reached into the pouch, pulled out a handful of gold coins, and tossed them contemptuously on the table. The coins landed with a splash, melting into a brown gunk. A ghastly stench of excrement spread around. The customers of the Natura Rerum Osteria leapt to their feet and dashed for the exit, choking and covering their noses with napkins. The maitre d'hotel bent over and retched. There was a scream and a curse. Phoebus Ravenga didn't even twitch. He stood like a statue, arms crossed on his chest. Moose, dumbfounded, shook his head, goggled and rubbed his eyes, staring at the stinking pile of shit on the tablecloth. He finally roused himself and reached into the pouch and pulled out a handful of soft gunk.
You're right, Moose, said Phoebus Ravenga in an icy voice. Shit will always be shit. Into the courtyard with him.
The court scribe didn't even put up any resistance as he was hauled away, too bewildered by what had happened. Tharp dragged him to the outhouse. At a sign from Ravenga, two servants removed the wooden cover of the latrine. Moose became animated at the sight and began to yell, struggle and kick. It didn't help much. Tharp hauled him to the earth closet and threw him down the opening. The young man tumbled into the sloppy excrement. But he didn't go under. He spread out his arms and legs and held his head up, keeping himself on the surface of the muck with his arms on bunches of straw, rags, sticks and crumpled pages from various learned and pious books. Phoebus Ravenga took down from the wall of the granary a wooden pitchfork made from a single forked branch.
Shit was, is, and will remain shit, he said, and always ends up where shit is.
He pressed down on the pitchfork and submerged Moose. Completely.
Moose broke the surface, roaring, coughing and spitting.
Ravenga let him cough a little and get his breath back, and then submerged him again, this time much deeper. After repeating the operation several times, he threw down the pitchfork.
Leave him, he ordered. Let him crawl out by himself.
That won't be easy, adjudged Tharp, and it'll take some time.
Let it. There's no rush.
À mon retour, hey, je m'en désespère. Tu m'as reçu d'un baiser tout glacé. Pierre Dronsard.
Chapter 16. Just at that moment, the Novigradian schooner, Pandora Pavi, a beautiful ship indeed, was sailing to its mooring place under full sail. Beautiful and swift, thought Geralt, descending the gangway onto the busy wharf. He had seen the schooner in Novigrad, asked around, and knew it had set sail from there 2 whole days after the galley Stinter on which he had sailed. In spite of that, he had essentially reached Kerak at the same time.
Perhaps I ought to have waited and boarded the schooner, he thought. 2 days more in Novigrad. Who knows? Perhaps I would have acquired some more information.
Vain digressions, he decided.
Perhaps, who knows, maybe.
What has happened. Nothing can change it now, and there's no sense going on about it. With a glance, he bade farewell to the schooner, the lighthouse, the sea and the horizon darkening with storm clouds. Then he set off for the town at a brisk pace. Just at that moment, 2 porters were coming out, carrying a sedan chair, a dainty construction with delicate lilac curtains.
It had to be Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. On those days, Litanea